Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4, packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It's 12:03 on Wednesday afternoon, December 4th. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us on the Noon Business Hour. I'm Rob Hart. Restaurant chain Chi-Chi's making a comeback. We'll get the details in our next segment. But right now, a report on private sector jobs leads today's data. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Gus Fauché, Chief Economist, PNC Financial Services in Pittsburgh. Gus, thank you for joining us today, and it's the ritual of every jobs week. Of course, it ends on Friday morning, 7:30 local time, when the government jobs report for the month of November will be released. But the Wednesday before, we always get the private payroll report from the payroll processor ADP. And Gus, because of differences in methodology, the ADP number often is wildly divergent from the government number. So with ADP clocking at 146,000 jobs for the month of November. What could that tell us potentially about the number we'll see on Friday morning?
We're expecting 265,000 jobs added in November when you get the government report on Friday from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The November ADP report was surprisingly lower than what we had in October, which, given the impact of the hurricanes we had last month, given the settlement of the Boeing strike, we might have expected to see stronger job growth in November than in October. So I'm kind of discounting the ADP report. I think we'll get a very good government jobs report on Friday, and I think the labor market continues to do well.
And it seems like the labor market, though, as far as job growth is concerned, of course, whatever the number that comes out on Friday morning could render this entire discussion moot. But it seems like it's starting to plateau, that businesses are not laying off workers. They're holding on to the talent that they have acquired over the course of the Great Resignation, but they're not really putting a great deal of effort into adding more people.
That's correct. We've seen the hiring rate, the share of workers who are being hired every month, that has definitely slowed over the past couple of years. I think what we see is that businesses are replacing workers who leave, that they may be hiring a few workers here and there, but we don't have the large-scale hiring that we experienced in 2022, early 2023, when demand was recovering from the pandemic.
Now, wage growth, according to ADP, picked up by 4.8%. That is faster than October. If that's always great, you want to see wage growth pick up. But at the same time, in the fight against inflation, how would the Fed interpret that number?
That's right. The Fed is closely watching wage growth. What we do see is that wages, whether we're looking at the ADP report or the Bureau of Labor Statistics report, they are going up a little faster than inflation, so that's good news. The question is, are workers more productive? Are they producing more, in which case we can have stronger wage growth without contributing to inflation? Or is it a tight labor market driving up wage growth, which means that we may see businesses start to raise their prices again? So the Fed will be watching this very closely, wage growth, to make sure that we're not getting more inflationary pressures coming from the labor market.
Gus Fauché, Chief Economist, PNC Financial Services in Pittsburgh, thank you for joining us today. Coming up, a Mexican food restaurant chain is coming back after a two-decade hiatus.
Lunch money for all generations. This is the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
Mexican restaurant chain Chi-Chi's, which closed 20 years ago, is making a comeback. Let's talk about the return with R.J. Hadavi, head of analytical research at the foot traffic analysis firm Placer AI in Chicago. RJ, thank you for joining us today. And when I posted this story on Facebook yesterday, I was surprised at the reaction, because apparently the mere mention of the name Chi-Chi's brings back memories of free appetizers when you couldn't afford a lot, or maybe spending your 21st birthday there, or just hanging out at Chi-Chi's at the mall before or after a movie. So just based on nostalgia alone, RJ, this seems like it's going to be a home run.
Yeah, you're right. And obviously, we've spoken about the nostalgia trend in restaurants the last couple of years, whether it's reintroducing iconic menu items like the Mexican pizza Taco Bell or the adult Happy Meal at McDonald's. It was just the next logical conclusion that we saw a chain that people fondly remember for nostalgia reasons make a comeback. And it's certainly not the only one. We're starting to see other chains, long-forgotten chains, start to reopen as well, even in a difficult operating environment for restaurants.
Now, the Chi-Chi's trademark is owned by Hormel Foods. The son of its founder is going to reopen the restaurant starting next year. And Chi-Chi's, for those of you who don't know, got its start in Minnesota in 1975. And one of the co-founders was a Green Bay Packers legend and longtime broadcaster. The color commentator, along with Jim Irwin on WTMJ, Max McGee, was one of the principal founders of Chi-Chi's and cashed out at the right time, RJ. Because the name changed hands many times before a hepatitis outbreak ended the restaurant for good in 2003. But apparently the name brings up a lot of positive memories for people. But I want to ask you, RJ, just about that particular restaurant space, because Chi-Chi's, TGI Fridays, Applebee's, they were all kind of staples of the shopping mall landscape way back when. And they seem to be having a hard time making their way today.
Yeah, it's been a difficult environment. We've got a situation where food costs are definitely up from where they were pre-pandemic. Labor is a difficult issue. Being able to find enough workers and employees is definitely a challenge for most restaurant operators. On top of that, too, it's more expensive to build out these restaurants than it was just a couple of years ago. So that's why we are starting to see a lot of bankruptcies in the space, whether it's TGI Fridays or others. It's been a difficult environment. But at the same time, we've seen a lot of these nostalgia plays work really more at the product or promotional strategy level, but not at the chain level. So it'll be interesting to see how this works out. It hasn't changed. It is a difficult environment, but we have some nostalgia as a major visitation driver in this environment. And so it's not surprising to see chains like Chi-Chi's or Steak and Ale start to make a comeback, these names that really resonate with people from yesteryears, days past. So I think it'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
And RJ, I think this is a pretty interesting conversation to have coming on the heels of our discussion yesterday about the revamp of Pizza Hut and just the idea that today, are there just a lot of cheap places to hang out anymore? A place where you can, I mean, one of the stories I heard when I posted the story about Chi-Chi's coming back was that if they used to have like free appetizer days, and if you weren't making a whole lot of money, Chi-Chi's was a great place to go to load up on chips and salsa for free and just have a place to hang out and not break the bank. Do those places exist today, and is there a great deal of demand for them?
I think we're starting to see that. I mean, I think it's no secret that we're dealing with a very value conscious, a very deal driven consumer, one that's been hit by other macro headwinds the last couple of years, whether it's inflation or other cost pressures. And so we're starting to see it across a lot of categories that people are looking for cheaper alternatives or just places to hang out. It's interesting. We were looking at data for Black Friday this past weekend. And interestingly, it looks like the malls outperformed the stores themselves, people wanting just to go to the mall for the different experiences and just hang out as opposed to actually shopping. So we're seeing it not just in restaurants, but across the broader retail environment as well.
Okay, Pizza Hut has been revamped. Chi-Chi's is coming back. Is a resurrection of Bennigan's, is that in the cards?
It's already happening. They're actually already starting to make moves on it. And so you'd be expecting that to come. They are with the parent company Steak and Ale. They are making a comeback as well. So I think you're on the same wavelength there, Rob.
We can dine out like it's 1999. RJ Hadavi, head of analytical research at the foot traffic analysis firm Placer AI in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, why there may be tax implications for something you win at a holiday office party.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Personal Finance Wednesday. There's a possibility the IRS could tax your gifts from office raffles, secret Santa exchanges, and white elephant swaps. Let's learn more from Mark Gallegos, tax partner with Port Brown's tax services team in Elgin. Mark, thank you for joining us today. And if you do win a prize at your holiday office party, do you have to report the cash value of that ceramic egg you may have won in some sort of white elephant gift contest?
Yeah, that is a great question. And the IRS generally considers prizes and awards, including those won at raffles or holiday contests, as taxable income. And this applies whether the winnings are cash or non-cash, such as merchandise, gift cards, travel packages, etc.
Now, what is the threshold of value in which you would have to report winnings to the IRS?
So they say that any cash prizes you get are fully taxable as ordinary income, and non-cash, it's the fair market value of what you receive. And so it's all taxable to you. The question is, do you get something reported to you? So a form W-2G is reported to you when you have winnings of 600 or more, or you may even get a 1099 miscellaneous with other income. But in general, anything you win is taxable as ordinary income to you.
Now, that includes, let's say you have a Las Vegas night as part of the holiday party, but you pay cash to get the chips, for example, as part of the Las Vegas night activities, but then you can trade that in from some sort of prize. You know, you don't really win any money, but you can win like a set of golf clubs or something like that. You have to determine the cash value of that and then report it.
Yeah, the fair market value of that prize less what you paid for it, and that's the benefit you receive, so that would be taxable.
Now, in general, Mark, obviously, you know, the IRS, they got Capone. That you always say that about the Internal Revenue Service, but in general, how many people are popped on a yearly basis for not reporting things they want at the office holiday party?
Well, the IRS, it's less than 1% in their audit rate. They're not really going after the average person, looking for them to hit them over the head. They're just looking for everyone to be as compliant as possible. And, you know, they're looking for the real big whales and tax cheats out there.
Now, that's something you should think about if you are engaging, you want to participate in a contest at the office holiday party, or if you are planning an office holiday party and you want to stage that giveaway. Is that something that you should be thinking of as the planner?
It should be something, and maybe even have something already to let, you know, the winners know that this is something that's going to be taxable to them, or what does that look like, and how's it going to be reported, et cetera. I think those are things that always help everyone so they know on the front end what they're getting involved in.
Now, lastly, Mark, let's say you're the father of two boys and you live in Northwest Indiana and you win a leg lamp in a sweepstakes because of your mind powers. Should you report that to the IRS, even though your wife breaks it later on?
Well, yes. depending on the value of that leg lamp, right? I mean, maybe it's not worth anything, but in theory, yes. And keep in mind, it's only reported to the IRS, but the state also will get their piece of the pie as well.
So remember that at your office holiday party. Mark Gallegos, tax partner at the Port Brown Tax Services team in Elgin, thank you for joining us today.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon, I'm Rob Hart. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. There's more political madness in a South suburban village. The head of a major healthcare company is shot and killed in New York. Personal Finance Wednesday, the best strategies for helping your children purchase a home. U.S. airline executives are defending their seat fees before a U.S. Senate panel. WBBM Business, the markets are higher. The Dow is up 146 points, NASDAQ up 175, the S&P 500 is up 18. We have 36 degrees right now under cloudy skies. It's 12:31, topping our news at the half hour. Thornton Township Supervisor Tiffany Henyard will not be on the ballot for next year after the Democratic Party caucus said she did not have the full slate which was required. This supporter tells CBS News Chicago,
"I think it's very unfair that I don't get a chance to make the decision of who I want where. I wanted to vote for Tiffany."
Illinois State Senator Napoleon Harris, who also serves as the Thornton Township Democratic Committeeman, will be on the ballot for supervisor. United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson has been killed on his way to an investor meeting in New York City. Reporter Marla Diamond is with our sister station 1010 Winds in New York.
Thompson was shot once in the chest and rushed to Mount Sinai West in critical condition. Doctors there were not able to save him. Now, police are still searching for that suspect. He was last seen wearing a cream-colored coat about 5 feet 10 inches, and he was wearing a black mask.
Investigators believe it was a targeted attack. It's 12:32 as the Noon Business Hour continues. Markets are higher today. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Jim Awad, Senior Managing Director, Clearstead Advisors in New York. Jim, thank you for joining us today. After a couple of days of slowing down, it seems like the post-election rally rally might be back on.
Yeah, part of it is seasonal, that investors like to be optimistic during the last few weeks of the year because, frankly, money managers get paid more if their accounts go up. So there's a bias to the upside. Also, last night after the close, you had Salesforce report very strong earnings, which ignited the software, AI, and technology sector, which is pulling up the market. And then the ADP and ISM services numbers today showed an economy that's growing, but not too hot. So you'll continue to get growth and growth in corporate profits. But if the Fed is right, inflation should continue to gradually decline, which should allow for one more rate cut this year. So it's not a bad cocktail for stock price.
Now, obviously, there's always a great divergence between the ADP number and what is reported by the government on Friday morning because of just changes in methodology that have different ways of counting people. What is the consensus for Friday morning? It could be well above 146,000 or it could be well below.
Yeah, there's really quite a dispersion in estimates. I've seen as low as 150 and as high as 275. And we don't know. There's a possibility for surprise. I doubt that it'll be on the downside because you're making up for the storms and the hurricanes, which should add about 100,000 jobs. The risk is that it's too strong, and that therefore investors start to rethink that 70% probability they currently have for one additional rate cut this year. I think the market, they could live with it, but I think they prefer one more rate cut and are expecting a pause for several months next year. So if you don't want to upset that apple cart of expectations, and too strong a number could be disappointing.
I mean, there has been a remarkable run-up in the markets since the bull run began 2 years ago. We're closing in on Dow 45,000, S&P over 6,000, NASDAQ has 20,000 in its sights. But you're starting to hear the B word get bandied about, bubble. Is this a market that's properly valued?
Look, it's not a cheap market, but you have excellent fundamentals. Estimates for the economy growth keep going up. Estimates for corporate profits seem solid. You're going into a period of less regulation and tax cuts. So the market's not cheap, but the fundamentals are good. So I think the issue there is to be careful on what you own, but to stay invested, because equities are likely to do better than cash or bonds for next year.
And then let's talk about the downstream effects on the American consumer and on the economy. If you look at your 401k balance or just look at your portfolio in general, and then you combine that with if you're in a house with a low mortgage rate that was locked in during the pandemic, if you look at your portfolio value and you look at your home appraisal, even if you're solidly middle class, you're going to be feeling pretty good.
You're feeling pretty good about your prospects. You're still stretched by the amount that prices have gone up over the last 2 years. But the holiday spending was good. Holiday travel was good. I think the risk for next year, aside from geopolitical risk and any policy mistakes, is that the economy is too strong. Inflation stops going down or either reaccelerates. And all of a sudden in the spring, we're talking about rate increases rather than rate declines, and that is not priced into equity prices.
And then have we had a real chance yet, from an academic sense or just taking the long view now, just looking at all the twists and turns in the economy going from COVID to inflation to interest rates being ratcheted up to their highest level since the 90s, this has been a head-spinning couple of years.
It certainly has been, and what it's shown is the power of the American economy to deal with all that adversity, all that uncertainty, and you can't hold the American consumer down unless you hit he or she on the head. And businesses are there to spend to support American consumers. So if you have consumer spending and business spending, that's most of the economy. The government is a whole other subject. which would take a separate interview.
Jim Awad, Senior Managing Director of Clearstead Advisors in New York, thank you for joining us today. Coming up next in Personal Finance Wednesday, ways to give your children a leg up when they're looking to buy a home.
Cashing in with conversation, the WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Hey, it's Personal Finance Wednesday, and in this segment, we're looking at ways parents can help their adult children purchase a home. Let's get some ideas from Sherry Greco-Rikus, co-founder of Rappaport-Rikus Capital Management in Chicago, author of the book Maximize Your Return on Life. Sherry, thank you for joining us today. And first off, you know, in general, when someone buys a home, a first-time home buyer, of that group, how many are getting financial help from their parents or from their family in some form or fashion?
You know, I don't have the statistics, but with my clients, it's more and more because it's gotten really expensive and, you know, often the parents want to help the children. But when my clients come to me and ask me about helping their children, I kind of look at two things. First of all, their values. And so many of my clients, family is a huge value. So helping their children while they're alive and seeing that help is so great for them. But the other big issue that I talk to them about is making sure that either gifting, signing a loan, helping with the down payment, we're going to talk about all that in a moment, doesn't impact their retirement because they've worked hard, and I want to make sure that their retirement is not impacted on helping the kids. And sometimes there's a happy median to that as well.
And there is, you talk about spending money. Sometimes it's an expense. Sometimes it's an investment. I would imagine if you are trying to help an adult child purchase a home, you see that as an investment. And what is the smartest way to go about doing that?
Yeah, and it certainly is an investment because being a homeowner, you know, your children can begin to get equity, and it really, and again, it's such a thoughtful, wonderful gift for a parent. So there's a couple ways you can do it. One is you can help them with the down payment. And the current gifting rules, which will not go against your overall exemption, again, always talk with your estate planning attorney, but you can give $18,000 per child. So if a husband and wife want to give to their children, they can actually give $36,000. And then if your child is married, you can each give $18,000 to your child. You can also give it to your child's spouse. And that's another $36,000, which is about $72,000. Now we're in December and the gifting clock starts in January. So if your children are looking for a home in the first quarter of 2025, the limit is now $19,000. So you can give $72,000 in 2024 and $76,000 in 2025, which doesn't affect any of your accounting and your exemptions. Now, currently the exemption is at $13 million per person, $27 million for a married couple. So a lot of times people aren't even close to that, but exemptions could go down, and that's still in flux right now.
We're talking about helping your adult children buy a home with Sherry Greco-Rikus, co-founder of Rappaport-Rikus Capital Management in Chicago. In your experience, what is the most common form of financial assistance? Is it that down payment gift that we were talking about, or do your clients find themselves in a situation where they're paying a portion or all of their monthly mortgage payment?
You know, I don't see that. What I see more often is that they will give a loan to the children, and there is something called the ARF, the applicable federal rate to give interfamily loans, and you can get that at the IRS.gov. But that rate is usually less than you would get from a bank. So it's kind of a win-win for both the parents because they're getting a fixed rate and the children. But you have to be careful. One is you should record that loan so that the child can get the tax advantages. If you have multiple children, you have to keep that in mind. Are you going to be giving the loans to all your children? And I like the loan because if a spouse is involved, they both have signed the loan. When you give the gift, it's kind of gone. And we all know what happens in the future. Not every marriage does last. So I really like the loan option. A third option that I've seen, but not as frequently, is co-signing the loan. So the kids can't quite qualify, so the parents will co-sign. But you have to be very careful because your credit could suffer if they don't make the payments. And you also, again, if your child is married, you want to be sensitive to that. And also if you have other children. So, you know, you can gift the down payment. You can give them a loan, a family loan, and you can co-sign. Those are the three ways that I've seen parents help their children.
Sherry Greco-Rikus, co-founder of Rappaport-Rikus Capital Management in Chicago, author of the book Maximize Your Return on Life. Join us at this time tomorrow for Technology Thursday. And still to come, airline executives are on the hot seat in Washington.
Money conversation that pays a big dividend. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Executives from top American airlines are testifying before a Senate panel today. Let's discuss the line of questioning with Joe Sweeterman, professor of public services and director of the Chaddick Institute at DePaul University in Chicago. Joe, thank you for joining us today. And what is the purpose of this Senate hearing? What do they want to get to the bottom to? I mean, do they just want to scold airline executives for charging these so-called junk fees on to select your own seat and things like that?
I think the executives probably rather be almost anywhere else in the world than in front of that Senate this morning, because it is a follow-up on President Biden's concern about junk fees. So they're getting grilled from all sides on, you know, seat fees, cancellation penalties, and so forth. And the airlines are holding their ground. They're making the argument that, you know, you're not going to have basic economy and bargain basement fares, matching Spirit and Frontier, unless you have these restrictions. So they're there's a lot of stress in the room this morning.
Now, you used to be in the legacy carrier side of the business, and looking back on key moments in the history of the airline industry and how airlines assessed fares, I mean, obviously the big one is deregulation in 1978, but how much of a bomb or how much of how big of an impact was the arrival of Expedia on airline fares and how you kept up with the competition?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, there's such, we call that fare transparency, where people could search in an instant, see all the options. And I was out at United, you know, when I started there, a lot of people were still making phone calls to different airlines, reading newspaper ads, and it was hard to find fares to compare. And of course, with the internet, everything is so transparent. And what that did was really give a marketing angle to discounters to come in, because they could instantly reach, you know, the masses. And so the big guys had to figure out how to compete with that. And the first big thing, and I was there when it happened, was making certain fares non-refundable. That was a big deal, that, you know, if you want a cheap fare, you're going to lock in. And that's going to the start of what was a whole set of fees they have now.
And then when it comes to assessing fees, it's a $12.4 billion enterprise across American, United, Delta, Spirit, and Frontier between 2018 and 2023. And they're not going to walk away from that source of revenue willingly. And if they have to, either because they've been forced to via legislation or because of the regulatory environment, they would say probably, well, we're going to have to cut to make up for that loss of revenue.
Yeah, that's right. And there's almost a time warp aspect in these hearings, because 5-8 years ago, there was a lot of discussion about these fees and where these come from. Now it's just a fact of life in the airlines that you want something, you pay for it. And we just heard recently, for example, Frontier is adding a first class service. Airlines are fast reconfiguring the airplanes to have more seats with extra room. And all those are kind of fee based systems. And so this is really a debate about something that's going in the opposite direction, maybe what the legislators want to see.
Joe Sweeterman, professor of public services and director of the Chaddick Institute at DePaul University in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today.